Hello, I am your co-host, Joan Howe. Charlie Gordon is your other co-host. We are the History Boys, and this is episode 12 of the Historic Present Podcast. In today's episode, we chat to Joshua Levine, one of the genii behind making the blockbuster film we all know and love, Dunkirk, as historically accurate as a movie will allow it. As well as taking a behind-the-scenes peek into the process of making Christopher Nolan's masterpiece, we take a deeper look into the historical events that led to the thousands of men stranded on a beach in northern France. Let's get into it.
All right, so hello everyone, welcome back. And for today's history, we are joined by author and historian Joshua Levine. Josh, hello.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Brilliant to have you on. So Josh is a historian mainly focusing in, I think, World War II, and I think more specifically Dunkirk, where he's written a book about it, as well as being on the set of the movie Dunkirk, the movie that everyone knows. Absolutely fantastic film. I'm sure Joshua had a lot of, was the mastermind behind the historical accuracy of the film itself. So Joshua, can you tell us a bit about what it was like working on that set?
Yeah. I was lucky to be asked to do it. So I've done lots of books down the years about all sorts of different subjects. And one I had done, in fact, quite an early one, was an oral history, which I'd edited about Dunkirk. And the idea was, had been to make it kind of a narrative history. So whereas a lot of oral histories have been, you know, throwing out lots of stories, big chunky stories, what I wanted to do was to sort of hone it down a bit and tell the narrative story of Dunkirk through individual accounts. And a lot of these accounts disagreed with each other, contradicted. I wanted to get a sense that it was all quite a messy business. And the director, a man called Christopher Nolan, had seen that book. I think he'd been given it by his wife for Christmas. I'm assuming the only gift he got that year, and had decided that it sort of tied in with his idea of the event, of it being lots of different stories, lots of, lots and lots of different things happening, many, many different individual stories which went in to make up the big story. So he asked me, or I got a phone call asking me to come on board, basically, and to work with them. And so he came along to my house, this would be a few years ago, and brought the script with him. And I didn't know at the time, I mean, I knew I'd heard of him, but I love film, but I wasn't really aware of a lot of his stuff. So I didn't quite know how big he was. So he came with the film script, and I didn't realize, you know, he was very, very protective over his material, and he left the film script. We talked and talked and talked. He ate me out of biscuits, and he left the script with me overnight. And I didn't realize that was a sort of quite a big honor. So I later found out that when Tom Hardy was given the script, Christopher Nolan stood over him while he read it, but he let me have it overnight. And so I read it, and I found it really interesting. I loved the fact that it kind of split the event into three, air, sea, and land. And you had these stories which interlinked. They were separate, but they sort of crossed over and interlinked. And it seemed to me that was very real. It was something really real about the way these stories, you know, people were having their own experiences, but then sort of crossing at different times and their story. And they would see whatever it was they saw from different perspectives, which of course, you know, when, you know, you know now, you're kind of young veterans yourself of this business, and you've read a lot and you've talked to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And even though there aren't too many First, Second World War veterans around, there's still a few. And you get a real sense when you talk to veterans of any conflict. You know, they see their side of it, their corner of it, whatever it is they see. And they're not necessarily keen to accept that something else happened or that there's another way of looking at things. And when you're interviewing people, obviously you don't want to alienate them. You don't want to annoy them. So you don't hammer it home that, you know, but that happened too. But you do start to build up a kind of patchwork rich sense of, you know, I used to be a lawyer years ago, and I would go into court, and you know, you would cross-examine people, you would listen to witnesses, and people would give very different accounts of the same event, and they weren't lying. You know, they were, in fact, if two people gave exactly the same account, then you'd have a pretty good idea that they were, you know, they got together to manufacture the evidence. People, you know, everybody sees and then interprets events differently. That's how human beings are. And absolutely the same goes with historical events, whether it's war or whether it's, you know, social events. That's how we see and interpret things. And so I found it very exciting to be working on this project where that's how he viewed it. It was people's individual stories, but from different angles. So you got these different interpretations, which seems to me is how things really were. So that was, you know, one of the excitements for me initially. And then, well, you know, okay, there's something to start with. That to me was interesting.
So the first draft, let's say, of the script Christopher Nolan gave to you overnight, how historically accurate was that? How far off from 100% accurate was it?
If you're working with a film, it's a film, you know, it's a work of fiction. So if you're the historical consultant on it, I suppose the way I approached it, is that you have to kind of pick your battles. You know, it's not a documentary. So, I mean, a good example of this would be, I don't know if you've seen the Battle of Britain film from 1969, which is where I love it, it's a great film. That's about as close as you're gonna get to a documentary, a film documentary. You know, it talks about the Battle of Britain very much from Dowding's perspective. And it's very close to the, you know, to the actual event. Except it's got this kind of love story tacked on, which is completely, you know, fiction. And that's kind of an extreme. I think most films, you know, there's a kind of a spectrum of films. Some are pretty close, some, you know, total fantasy. And then some, and you've got that, what's the film about the X-Troop? Tarantino, Inglourious Basterds. Which is, you know, I love, now a lot of people take real exception to that film. I love it. It's a total fantasy. You know, yeah. Hitler and the leading Nazis all get massacred in the cinema at the end. We know that didn't happen, you know. But I love the fact, it's such an amazing catharsis, such an amazing release to, oh, if only that had happened. Yeah. And it's wonderful to watch. Now, no one in their right mind is going to claim there's any historical accuracy there whatsoever. It's a fantasy, but it's kind of a glorious fantasy to watch. It's something that I found incredibly liberating to even see someone imagining it happen. So, you know, there's a big scope from total accuracy. No, nothing's totally accurate, but, you know, good accuracy to the other end of the scale. And even within that, you can look at it in different ways. So when I saw the first draft of this one, I thought it was pretty accurate. You know, it's pretty good. There are certain things that I took issue with. I mean, let's take an example. The way the pilots were talking to each other, for example, they were using kind of, I don't know if you've ever seen any sort of films about 1970s CB radio, where people in America would talk to each other over, and they would say, you know, use very sort of modern copy that and all this kind of thing.
Yeah,
the pilots were talking to each other with that kind of modern language. So that was an example where I said, you know, you've got to. In fact, one thing I did was go to a couple of Battle of Britain pilots and say, look, how would you speak to you? You wouldn't speak like this. How would you speak on the radio? And they sort of talked me through. So that was something that was quite important. I thought you really have to get this right. There were a couple of key events in the story that's, you know, I thought, well, I've got to have a real look at this to see if anything like this happened. There were a couple of things we talked, for example, fires landing, wheels down on the beach. You know, that was a conversation we had. That really did happen. and certain things like that. And the Spitfire ditching in the sea, that's a really interesting one, because that, again, did happen. And somebody did get out. In a film, it takes a long time. It takes much longer than it would do. In, you know, Spitfire's all metal. It'll go down pretty fast. But one did stay afloat long enough for somebody to get out. We had lots of conversations about the best way he should be seen to get out. What did he actually have in there? You know, he had his flare gun. Could he sort of hammer? You know, there were all sorts of conversations about how it would be best. And in the end, you know, certain things. So it was important to me that, you know, that had happened. Therefore, that can be shown. The Spitfire landing wheels down can be shown. There are certain other things. So, for example, let's say the Spitfire is flying very low. You know, in reality, the Air Force was pretty high. Fighter Command was high up. There were reasons for fighting. You know, you probably know that, you know, the RAF and the Navy at Dunkirk were both furious. Sorry, the Army and the Navy were furious with the RAF. They had this perception that the RAF wasn't there. They weren't being protected. But every time the Luftwaffe came in, they seemed to be pretty much unmolested. Now, actually, that wasn't the case. The case was that the RAF really was there. They were much higher, you know, they weren't as low as they appeared. But the fact was, you know, it seemed to me that this wasn't a battle that was completely worth having. You know, the film would be very different if they were only ever see, you know, if you didn't see the aeroplanes higher. You had to see them. There was a filmic element to this. And there was lots of that. There was lots of arguments over, not arguments, but debates over the filmicness of it. So, for example, at the very beginning of the film, you see leaflets coming down. Now, the Germans had genuine leaflets, which, you know, they dropped. I had a look at those real leaflets and decided, you know, I showed them to Christopher Nolan, and he liked the idea of them, but he completely redrew them. They became a sort of shorthand so that, you know, the audience could see these redrawn leaflets, and it gives them so much information, you know, really quickly. You know, so in other words, the Germans, we are here, you are surrounded. And that meant that lots of clunky dialogue didn't have to take place. So that was a great thing to be able to encourage him to put in, even though the leaflet he used wasn't actually the original leaflet. So there's lots of sort of discussions to make it as accurate as possible. But, you know, in the end, it's his film and he's making a film, something that's entertainment, something that people are going to want to watch. You know, so I can't just police the whole thing and say, can't have that, can't have that, can't have that. It's a compromise, like everything.
It sounds fascinating being on that set. One of my favourite films, to be perfectly honest with you. I've watched it on planes, I've watched it at home. It's just a fantastic film. But the historical context of Dunkirk, there's a lot more to it than people know about. And can you, Josh, tell us a bit about how the situation at Dunkirk came about?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's this sort of debate over whether Dunkirk is this glorious, you know, this glorious evacuation, or whether it's part of a great defeat. And the answer is, you know, the Battle of France was a disaster, absolute disaster. You've got the British Expeditionary Force, you know, going out to France. This is in September 1939. So, you know, they're going out and they're sitting in France. They're not allowed into Belgium, eventually. Belgium is neutral. So they're sitting in France and they're fully expecting the Germans to come forward. And once the Germans do mount their attack, they suspected the German attack is going to come into Belgium. And so they're waiting for the German attack to come, so the British Expeditionary Force themselves are going to move into Germany. So they have, you know, the British soldiers have this kind of strange period of the phony war, where they almost become tourists. They're in France, and they're getting used to this new life. So you've got this amazing image of these British soldiers coming over to France. They've never been abroad before. They're young. Well, they're not all young. Some of them actually are older. The pioneer troop. Pioneer soldiers are actually, you know, quite a lot older, up to 50 years old, some of them. But they're coming across. They haven't been abroad before. And they're sort of settling in. And they have all these strange sort of adventures. You've got one man, an English soldier, who actually marries a French woman while he's out there. And then on the retreat back to Dunkirk, she's actually with him. And she comes over on the boat. So you have these strange events that are happening in France. But then the fighting begins. The British Expeditionary Force moves into Belgium to meet the Germans. And everybody is pretty much expecting a sort of First World War type war of attrition, you know, with trenches. Because the Germans have moved into Belgium, the British and the French and the Belgians are there to meet them. And then, of course, you've got the Maginot Line to the south. The Maginot Line was this series of forts, which were pretty much, you know, it was considered they were impassable. You know, the French, ils ne passeront pas, they will not pass. And they were absolutely state of the art. You know, the Germans couldn't possibly get past. And the Germans didn't get past. They didn't try and get past. What the Germans did was to go through the Ardennes. And this extraordinary, audacious plan, which Hitler was fully behind. And, you know, once Hitler succeeded, this is to some degree where his hubris came from, the idea that, you know, he's a genius. He succeeded here, and he will succeed in everything else he does from here onwards. The plan was to go through this hilly and wooded area, the Ardennes, which was considered impassable. The French barely had it defended, only not particularly good reserve troops. And the panzers pushed their way through. And within 10 days, by the 20th of May, they'd reached the coast. And they virtually surrounded the British Expeditionary Force and the French who were to the north. So it was just an amazing event, really. The British ended up having to retreat. So they moved forward from France to Belgium, to the River Dyle. And now they were having to retreat. And the British troops didn't know why they were retreating at first. So individual units, you'd have, you know, individual battalions moving backwards who thought, well, we must have done something wrong. We're being taken out of the line. We don't know why. And it was only after a period of time that they came to realize everyone's retreating. And of course, they'd been heroes to the French and to the Belgians when they were arriving. You know, there's lots of pictures of, you know, British soldiers with their arms around French women. You know, they've come as the saviors. And now they're almost immediately, they're moving backwards. And the French were shaking their fists at them, sort of shouting, pourquoi? Why are you moving back? You just come to help us. Now you're moving back. No one knew what was going on. The Belgians, who were, you know, quite used to intrusion from the Germans, you know, lots of Belgian refugees were now on the roads. So you had the British moving back alongside these civilian refugees. So it was kind of chaos. You had the British, you know, stopping at various points along the way to, you know, fight at different places. You had then a man who was, I think, pretty much unheralded, Lord Gort, who was the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, who really, you know, when the politicians, including Churchill in London, were saying that, you know, we must keep fighting, we must keep fighting, Gort realized the situation, and Gort ordered the retreat to Dunkirk. He basically decided, well, you know, the only chance we have is if we get the army away, and we have to retreat to Dunkirk. So you ended up with this depressing retreat where people, again, you have talked about there was no one story. People were in every different kind of condition. You know, you had some people who were, you know, retreating on trucks who didn't face any combat. Most British troops didn't ever see the Germans on the retreat. You know, they just were moving backwards. Some people weren't in too bad condition, you know, looting, living off the land, doing all right. And of course, the perimeter around Dunkirk was being protected by French troops and British troops. And in many ways, these are the real heroes of the story. You don't hear very much about them. No. Because they were the people who, first of all, protecting the corridor as the British soldiers, just British, you know, French came back as well, Belgians came back as well. As they were, you know, moving backwards, they were being protected by soldiers who were fighting, first of all, on the corridor into Dunkirk, and then the perimeter around Dunkirk. And these people, a lot of them realized that they were sacrificing themselves. They were sacrificing themselves so the army could pass through them to get away. You had the French who were defending the kind of western sector of the perimeter, the British who were defending, and you get these amazing stories. I mean, one story I found about, they were Coldstream Guards, guardsmen who, it was absolutely amazing. You know, they were told that they were going to have to defend the perimeter, which they took very, very seriously. A junior officer subaltern called Langley told this story. And he said that, you know, they were defending one area. The Germans were trying to push in and come in. And, you know, he said that, you know, we had another unit, I think it was a border regiment on our side. And an officer came to see me from the border regiment and said, you know, we are now going to retreat. And he said, no, we have orders. We must stay here. We're fighting to the last man. And the border regiment said, no, my colonel says that we can retreat. And Langley's senior officer said, if you take one step beyond that tree there, then we will shoot you. And Langley leaves it vague, but what he basically says is that this officer went back and had a conference with his own officers and then stepped beyond the tree. And he basically, you know, they fired. So you had these extraordinary, you know, this was happening on the perimeter. People were taking it incredibly seriously. You will fight the last man. And then you have... You've had the Germans moving, you know, the panzers. It's interesting, you know, this is where the panzers really, I suppose, and in Poland, where the panzers got this reputation for being so astonishing. You know, the individual panzer tanks were not better than what the British, the French had. The French were, you know, the strongest army at this time. It was the strategy of going through the Ardennes that really, you know, took everybody so by surprise, that made the Germans seem so invincible. You had the tanks. I don't know if you've heard of the Halt Order.
No.
The Halt Order was a great piece of fortune, basically, for the Allies, for the British. The Halt Order was the German tanks had shot through so quickly. They got to the basically to the edge of Dunkirk, and they were, you know, very close. The Germans were very close to completely surrounding, cutting off the Allies. They wouldn't be able to get, you know, into Dunkirk. They would have basically finished them off. And what happened was, first of all, Rundstedt and then Hitler confirmed the order. They made this order that the panzer tanks should stop. Now, there's been over the years this idea that Hitler was allowing the British, building a golden bridge, it's been called, for the British to be able to get away, because Hitler had such racial admiration for the British. Hitler's idea was, you know, we'll make peace with the British. The British can have their empire. We'll have our empire, and we can split the world between us. There's no doubt that, you know, Hitler did kind of think this way. He was fully expecting the British to make peace with him. Couldn't believe that the British carried on the war after Dunkirk. But there's no truth to the fact that Hitler was happy for the British to get away. A third of the ships that came to Dunkirk was either sunk or put out of action. Hitler wanted the British to be destroyed. But there were good reasons for stopping the tanks. They got so far ahead of the infantry that they were on their own, basically, and felt very vulnerable. There was the fact that they were, you know, they'd gone so far so fast that they were in pretty bad condition. They needed to be serviced and overhauled. And also there was still a lot of fighting to do south of the Somme. They wanted to allow Hermann Göring and the Luftwaffe finish off the British within the Dunkirk perimeter. Göring said to phone Hitler and said, look, let me do it. Don't let your generals do it. They're not staunch Nazis. We've been together from the very beginning. We, the Luftwaffe, I, Hermann Göring, we are your supporters. We are Nazis through and through. Let us do it. So we basically let the Luftwaffe finish off the British in the pocket and in the event. The Luftwaffe weren't strong enough to do it. And the panzers, after several days, did move on. But that was a stroke of luck. definite stroke of luck for the British. And then there were also, you know, the British at Arras mounted a kind of counter-offensive. It was a very limited one, but it was successful enough that the Germans became very scared that, you know, the pandas could actually be completely cut off and they would need rescue from Dunkirk rather than the British. So there were, you know, it wasn't the sort of cut and dried thing that people sometimes make it out as. But once the British were getting into Dunkirk, then they needed rescuing. And that's the story that we all know. And that's the story that the film sort of took on.
So, Joshua, in the movie, there's this great shot, or great for cinema at least, of a huge fleet of homegrown British ships emphatically sailing their way over to Dunkirk, ready to pick up all the British soldiers. I think there's a line by one of the generals. He looks into the binoculars and someone asks him what he can see, and he says, "Home," or something like that. It makes it great for cinema. But do we know how great it was for historical accuracy? Do we know how many ships actually sailed off from the ports of southern England to go and rescue those soldiers?
I don't know the precise number of ships, the little ships. The little ships are fair. We don't, because simply, you know, they were sort of brought along, you know, they were brought out in a very quick and ad hoc, like, you know, there were hundreds. And then, you know, when they got back to England, they weren't actually signed back in, whereas the big ships were. But it is absolutely true that an armada of little ships did show up. And it's slightly, the stories come to us slightly skewed, because the majority of them were actually crewed by Royal Naval members, not by their own owners. So, you know, there's a film, Mrs. Miniver, that was brought out during the war, which shows a man just jumping into a little ship and a little boat and bringing it across. For the most part, that didn't happen. There were some people who did that, but for the most part, these boats were requisitioned by the Navy and were brought out by the Navy. Now, actually, it would have been better in a lot of cases had they been brought out by their owners, because the Navy often didn't know how they, you know, properly how to use these boats, or the, you know, particular quirks of these boats. And a lot of them, you know, never came back because, you know, the Navy basically ran them into the ground. And there were people complaining and putting in claims for years afterwards, trying to get money back for their boats that they never... There's one story I found about a man, you know, people didn't know what was happening. And one man was walking along the towpath of the Thames and saw his boat being sailed away, and he was chasing after it. You know, someone was stealing his boat, as far as he was concerned. Had no idea where it was going. So there was quite a lot of stuff like that. These boats were requisitioned from, you know, different places around, mostly around the Thames or southern England. There were, you know, cockle boats from different little ports. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, strange old boats, what were they called, deal boats, you know, with sails. And all sorts of odd things were taken. And they did arrive in one sort of mass, particular mass. And so that's not actually an exaggeration, that there was a kind of armada, these little boats. But what people never realize is that they weren't there to take people back to England. They were there to ferry people from the beach to the larger ships offshore. That's what those little boats were there to do. So they were able to come inshore, pick up the troops. The Royal Engineers built these jetties, these piers made out of lorries, which they found initially, if they didn't burst the tires, the lorries would float away, and then they tethered them down and people would queue on the top on boards and ships would come alongside. So lots of people got away using those little ships onto the bigger ships, either destroyers or ferries offshore. The majority of people got away on the Mole, and that's shown a lot in the film, the Mole, which was a breakwater, never meant as a jetty at all. You know, it was a breakwater, and, you know, this brilliant man called Tennant, who was a Royal Naval senior naval officer ashore, he basically brought it into action on the 28th, decided we were going to need to get more people off, so let's try using this breakwater, which was just meant to stop the harbour from silting up with sand. Let's try using it as a jetty. He brought a ferry alongside. It worked, and they got the majority of people off on that Mole. So it was all, you know, trial and error. And being at Dunkirk, again, you know, was amazing because one, partly because it was just, I was so lucky to be there, but also you learned stuff from being there. And one thing I really learned, well, you know, so for example, in the National Archives, I've gone in and I found this document where a communications officer had said, you know, we brought a Marconi transmitter over to Dunkirk, and it was in action for about 7 or 8 hours, and then it broke because of sand in the generator. So this was what Tennant, who was a senior naval officer ashore, had been using this transmitter for a few hours so he could contact ships offshore and contact Dover. Really important he could do that. The rest of the time he was having to use the French equipment, which was back at, you know, a bit further back, or else go on to different ships and use their transmitter. So they brought this on for him, and it went out of action. I was thinking, sand in the generator. And I had this image of how did they do that? How did they break it? I mean, a couple of ratings, sand, and I just couldn't. And then when it was actually there for a long period of time, you realize these windstorms, you know, even in summer, I was there in May, June, and then the sand just whips up. It's like a desert sandstorm. And everybody, when we were there, was sort of wearing goggles and scarves across their mouth. And you realize that that's how it went out of action. You know, there was a sandstorm. And so you started to learn things from actually being there. And I think they, you know, again, when the trucks drift, you know, floated off in real life, I think, you know, they for the film, they built this truck jetty, and the same thing happened. So, you know, you have things that were happening in real life that were also happening in the making of the film, and it's a great way to learn. You know, very often it's important from a historical point of view to go to a place where something happened, because only then can you actually get the real sense of, you know, how that event might have played out.
So if I wrap up there, thank you so much for talking to us today. Such a great insight to the backstory of Dunkirk, how the British soldiers suddenly find themselves desperate to leave on a French beach. And also great to find out about your time working for the movie Dunkirk. So once again, thank you so much for coming on, and we should speak again sometime soon.
I'd love to. It'd been lovely talking to you.
Thank you.